Double toil and trouble, fire burn and cold drop, fillet and finish, and cold I am moon, toe back, tongue of dog, add his fork and blind one sting, lizards like an out of spring, for charm of powerful trouble, like a hell block, boiling bubble.
Welcome to the Don't Panic radio show. I'm Steve Vinson. That's Paul Schultz. And nothing you are about to hear is true. This is our third annual Halloween special. Not only is it our third annual, but it's our best. Our scariest.
Well, you know, we have Superfan James to thank for this episode.
Well, he's going to hate it. I already know that. So here's what you do. Go ahead and turn the lights down low. Maybe light a couple of creepy looking candles. You know, the kind with the wax kind of running down the side.
That's right. Possibly a skull candle if you can find
one. Yeah. And maybe, headphones. If you're alone.
Yes.
Grab yourself some of them headphones. I think they call them the cans. Yeah. That fit over your ears.
Well, they're earbuds now, but yes.
Oh, okay. And, you know, listen to it in the dark. Because our aim is to entertain you and scare you at the same time.
My aim is to scare Superfan James.
You know, I assume that he's taking his kid out trick-or-treating this year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he did last year, but as a parent, there's something fun about taking your kid trick-or-treating for about 5 years, mm-hmm. and then after that, it's just a big pain in the ass.
And then a couple years after that, you can just send them out the door. You know, they'll just go.
We went to Great Wolf Lodge recently,
mm-hmm.
which is... Yeah, water park, indoor water park, big hotel type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they have kids activities and stuff. One of the things they did is trick or treat, where you have a little map and you go around to each station. It tells you where to go.
Mm-hmm.
And you get your bag, you get your candy. So we're sitting in the hotel room. We're just like, go. Just go. So we sat there drinking, you know, gin and tonics and let the kids just go wandering around the hotel.
That's funny.
Not at all scary.
No.
But fun.
Well, you know, trunk or treat is like a big thing now. I don't know if you guys have ever done that.
Yes.
It's like the safe way to, you know, let your kids enjoy Halloween, apparently. And what's funny is my mom... wanted to do trunk or treat this year. So she got a hold of me and we ran some ideas around how she wanted to decorate her, you know, decorate her trunk. And today we were at the store buying all kinds of supplies for it. And she's just like, you know, I have bought more Halloween decorations for this stupid trunk or treat than I have bought. And I finished it. I'm like, my entire life as a child. She's like, yes, because I hate Halloween. But what's funny is the decoration, what we did was we're making her car into like a hearse, and we have a coffin sitting inside full of candy with this big skeleton in it. Well, we needed a box just the right size for the trunk, and I'm like, wait a minute, we can go to the comic shop. And I can get what's called a long box. And a long box is like, you know, it's like a 6 inches wide, almost 3 feet long, and about, you know, 10 inches deep. it looks like a perfect miniature coffin. Well, I go into my comic shop, and I ask the guy, I'm like, do you have any long boxes? He's like, yeah. So he gets me a long box, and I'm like, this will be perfect. I'm making a coffin for my mom. And he's like, is she going to fit in there? And I'm like, well, after I fold her up and kind of shove her in, she'll be just fine. He looked at me like, if I didn't know you.
Is your mom a midget?
After you fold her up a little bit, she will be.
Put her through the wood chipper. She'll fit. She'll fit just fine.
That's right.
You know, I think trunk or treat, in addition to being the safe alternative, is how we Americans take one step closer to integrating the car into every facet of our life.
I think you're right.
I think the next thing will be we'll go around singing Christmas carols, except we'll do it in a parking lot, and everybody will stay in their car, and we'll drive around in a convertible.
I think you may be onto something.
We'll have those top hats and the, you know, those coats and the with the scarves and everything. God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing ye dismay.
Well, hang on. You've already interjected Christmas into our Halloween show.
That's right.
Doesn't it happen in the real world enough?
I would say that that's an American thing to do, but apparently in Singapore, they start Christmas like in August.
I imagine in Singapore, every day is Christmas.
That's how you like to imagine it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. But I'm pretty sure my definition is different than most people's.
I don't know. Trick-or-treat used to be the way I imagine trick-or-treat.
Yeah.
It's dark. It's a little bit cold out. And you never know when some teenager is going to jump out from behind a bush.
Yeah. Yeah, we did it.
Scare you.
You and I did it for a couple years back in the day. You know, ran around in the dark. Yeah. You know,
We provided that service for free.
ran home, changed costumes, went back out.
That's right. But I heard this was a good one. I think my daughter saw this on YouTube or something. Mm. But dude, he took a mannequin, like a short mannequin,
mm-hmm.
and dressed it up as Spider-Man and hooked like a bag to its arm. Mm-hmm. You know, its arm's kind of out, and he hooked a bag to it. He'd go up to a house and set it down and ring the doorbell, and they would come out and go, oh, aren't you just the cutest little Spider-Man? And the guy would go, oh, he's deaf. And they'd go, oh, okay, well, here's you some extra candy, and put it in the bag of the mannequin. And then the guy would just go, thank you, pick up the mannequin and, like, put him on his shoulder and walk away.
Man, that's genius. I know what I'm doing this year.
Yeah.
One year, my son and I dressed up as we were both the Flash. I had the adult version. He had like the toddler version because he was like 4 or 5 at the time.
Yeah.
And we did the rounds. We went to all the big neighborhoods that were doing everything. And I remember getting just like the meanest look from other grown-ups walking around with their kids, like. You know, like, I guess they thought I was going up there and getting candy, too. I'm just like, why wouldn't you dress up on Halloween? It's the one time of the year you can, and no one's going to bat an eye. Right. Yeah, you do.
Usually as a slutty monster or something, or slutty, slutty nurse, slutty monster, slutty deck of cards, whatever it is, it's slutty.
Slutty ketchup bottle.
Yeah. Slutty prostitute. I wonder why nobody thought of that one.
That's in Singapore.
The earliest costume I can remember was I was 4 years old and I was Cinderella. Now, just to show you how open-minded my mom is, we were at Kmart in the costume aisle. And mm-hmm. I don't know, my dad must have just won the check pool or, you know. maybe his team had just won. And he had a little extra money. And she's like, you boys pick out whatever you want. my brother got like Batman or something. Mm-hmm. And I picked out Cinderella. And she's like, now, don't you want something maybe like a Superman or Spider-Man or maybe Frankenstein? I was like, you said we could pick out whatever we wanted. And I want Cinderella. Okay. So,
well, that's great.
4 years old. Later on, we're at the fire station, the Springfield Township Volunteer Fire Department, where they were having a family Halloween party. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I'm there with my brother, and his friends are there. And it's time for the parade of costumes, right? And so we all put our masks on.
Oh, it's a parade, all right.
It's like the original gay pride parade. So I got my Cinderella dress and I got my Cinderella mask, put my Cinderella, you know, the plastic thing with the rubber band on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like walking around, and somebody recognized my brother because they had seen him earlier. And they go, hey, mm-hmm. Mike, is this your little sister? He goes, no, it's my brother. They're like, oh. But the night passed uneventfully.
Who's gonna harass a 4 year old? I mean, but it is Springfield Township, though.
I feel like nowadays that would be all over like Facebook, mm-hmm. and Trump would tweet about it.
Yeah,
he'd be like, "See, this is what happens when the culture, when we let girls use the boys' bathroom," you know.
I just think it's funny that when you were 4 years old, you dressed up as Cinderella, and your youngest would dress up as Spider-Man.
That's a good point.
I just think it's funny. The best costume I ever had as a kid was I was the Headless Horseman. I was pretty happy with it.
Nice.
Yeah, but I don't have any story nearly as entertaining as that one. Although I did take getting back to Christmas taking over Halloween, one year I took my oldest, she was I think four or five, to go see Santa Claus, and I told her, you can pick out whatever outfit you want to wear to go see Santa Claus because I want to take your picture. So she comes out of her bedroom in her Supergirl costume, and I'm like, all right, let's do this. So we would get like the shittiest look from people as she's like standing there in line. I'm like, every once in a while, like somebody would like mutter something. I'm like, well, what's your kid wearing? You know, like, ooh, he's got a shirt on, you know, and the picture turned out so well that it was our family Christmas card. So
nice.
Yeah.
What's wrong with people? What's wrong with wearing a Supergirl costume to see Santa? Well,
It goes to my theory that, like, people see what you're doing and they go, I wish I had the guts to do that.
Yeah. Well, so far we haven't been scary, but we've been pretty entertaining. So why don't we move on to something a little disturbing. That's I don't want to, you know, I wrote this next one.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't find it particularly scary, but I do find it disturbing.
That's why I insisted you do it for the show.
This is part two of a multi-part story. Mm-hmm. I never intended it to have another part to it, but you convinced me to write a part two. I imagine there will be more parts.
I hope there is. It.
Yeah. And I also never intended it. I didn't know what the subject matter was,
mm-hmm.
In terms of the structure, like the plot, the central plot device.
Right.
All I knew, and if you haven't heard the first part, the last Halloween episode, the second annual.
Yes.
Has it. It's called Through the Eyes of Children or something like that.
Yes.
And part one. And it explores, I don't know, I just had this thought one day and sat down and started writing because I thought, what would happen if you had like a, I think something like a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old maybe, or maybe it was more like 7 and 4, something like that. But you have two young kids who kind of are starting to learn how to do things around the house.
Mm-hmm.
What if their parents left one day and didn't come back? Like, how would the kids handle that? And more importantly, how would they view it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what would that be like for a kid?
Right.
And it disturbed me so much that I had to put it down for a long time. I thought, you know, because I based it on my kids, and I even used their names in the first draft.
You were sending me messages. You're like, man, I wrote this and I cried.
It's true. Yeah, I had to change their names, actually. Because
mm-hmm.
I couldn't handle it, you know? And, but anyway, the first, for those of you that aren't going to bother to go listen to the first part, it's Emily and Sophie. And their parents leave and don't come back. And their grandma shows up and drives off with them. Okay.
Right.
That's pretty much, you know, part one.
Right.
Part two picks up from where that one left off.
Right.
And so what you're about to hear, second part of a story that started out as just an exploration of what would happen if the parents left. And now let's find out what would happen after Grandma comes and picks him up. Through the Eyes of Children, Chapter 2.
This message is transmitted at the request of the United States Office of Civil Defense at 3:40 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. NORAD detected a long-range nuclear missile launch in North Korea. This missile is believed to be headed in the direction of the Los Angeles metropolitan area. It is believed that it will impact this area within the next 1.5 to 2 hours.
Heat and mosquitoes. If it weren't for the heat and mosquitoes, it would have seemed almost like a camping vacation. One where you had to go on hikes and learn to shoot a gun. Ma had been taking Sophie and Emily out on these day hikes. Why they couldn't drive, Emily didn't know. All she could think of was figuring out how to get Sophie to stop whining about the heat and mosquitoes. "Why can't we drive to the shooting range, Ma?" asked Sophie. "It's good for you to get some exercise. Besides, we don't know when or if we'll be able to get gas, oil, parts. We have to conserve," said Ma. Every day, they'd go up before the sun, recheck that everything was securely locked in the truck, and hike through the woods to an old farm where Ma was teaching the young girls how to shoot. 2 months of this, and still no sign of anybody else around. Not even a plane flying over. The sky looked weird without all those white tails, just clear blue with a cloud here and there. "Today we hunt," announced Ma. "We ran out of protein bars, so we need to start shooting our protein." "I'm not killing any animals," declared Sophie. "You will kill stuff or starve," said Emily. "Nobody's starving," said Ma. "Now shh." They positioned themselves behind a slight rise at the same farm where they'd learned to shoot. The sun was just peeking over the distant hills, and the dew was starting to twinkle in the faint light. As they were laying there waiting for something edible to show itself, Emily thought about the past few months She could barely believe what she had seen and couldn't believe what the radio said was going on beyond her visible world. That day, a few months ago, Ma picked them up from Indianapolis, and that was the worst. It was great at first, because they were so relieved to see Ma and get a good cooked meal for a change. But Ma didn't cook. She just ate popcorn with Sophie and Emily, and she cried. They had to get up real early and run to Pawpaw's truck. Ma locked the doors and peeled out of the driveway. Emily had grabbed a flashlight, some bags of microwave popcorn, and her iPod. Sophie had grabbed some plastic dinosaurs and Danny, her stuffed stegosaurus. A couple of real survivalists they were. Anyway, Ma had brought a shotgun and some food from home. She said they would drive all day and all night on back roads to avoid getting stuck somewhere. They almost ran out of gas once because all the gas stations were out, except every once in a while they would see one that hadn't run out yet. Ma started stopping at every one of those. One nice man even let them have gas without paying after Ma had run out of money. Sometime during the second night, they stopped at a small Walmart outside a small town in Kentucky. It was dark inside, but people were still running in and out like they were open. Some people didn't even bother putting their stuff in bags. They just pushed their cart right to their truck and dumped everything in. Ma parked as close as she could get and turned off the engine. She gave Emily the keys, told her to drive off if anything had happened to Ma, or if it took Ma longer than an hour to come out of the store. Emily hoped she didn't have to figure out how to drive. Ma ran into the store and the girls sat, waiting, not saying anything, just watching the people run in and out of the Walmart. Sophie fell asleep. After a long time, Emily looked at the watch Ma had given her and was terrified to see that it had been an hour and 15 minutes. Still, she waited. She didn't want to leave Ma and figured she'd probably wreck the truck anyway. Suddenly, a loud crash. Then the back window was shattered. Another crash and the window fell out. Sophie screamed and kicked. A man, dirty, scraggly, had Sophie by the arm and was pulling her out of the window. Emily screamed for him to stop and tried to climb over the back seat to get to Sophie. Sophie was screaming and the man just kept pulling and telling her to shut up. He said they ought not be out here alone. But since they were, he figured, finders keepers. Emily jumped out the side door and ran around to the back of the truck where the man now had Sophie pinned down on her stomach. Emily picked up a rock and was about to throw it at the man when somebody grabbed her by the hair and threw her down on the concrete. A skinny woman was standing over her, telling her to lay still or else. She said Emily could wait her turn. Clyde would be done with her sister in a minute, and then she could have a turn. She must have meant that the man was going to give him a spanking because, well, Emily saw him starting to unbuckle his belt. Emily screamed and tried to get up, but the woman just knocked her back down. People were running by and just glancing, but it was like nobody could hear her calling for help. Sophie was crying and screaming while the man tore at her clothes. Emily kept trying to get up, but the woman threw her down again and again on her belly, and then she sat on her back. Emily was able to look up and see the man raise his arm to punch Sophie. Emily yelled, "Sophie!" Then a loud pop. The man looked like he threw his back out or something. Blood was running out of the corner of his mouth. He slumped over on top of Sophie. The skinny woman jumped up and yelled, "Clyde!" And that was the last thing she ever said. The back of her head flew open. Blood splattered all over. Ma was standing there with a rifle, three cartloads of stuff. She yelled at Emily for not driving off like she told her. She also said she was glad she got there when she did. So was Emily. So was Sophie. Back at the farm, Emily heard another pop and looked up from her spot behind the rise to see that Sophie had shot a squirrel. Woohoo! He yelled, Ma. Breakfast!
And now, from Weird-O-Rama, Victor Von Psychotron with The Conqueror Worm by Edgar Allan Poe. Lo, 'tis a gala night within the lonesome latter years. An angel throng, bewinged, bedlight in veils and drowned in tears, sit in a theatre to see a play of hopes and fears, while the orchestra breathes fitfully the music of the spheres. Mimes, in the form of God on high, mutter and mumble low, and hither and thither fly, mere puppets they, who come and go, at bidding of vast formless things that shift the scenery to and fro, flapping from out their condor wings invisible woe. That motley drummer, oh, be sure it shall not be forgot, with its phantom chased for evermore by a crowd that sees it not, through a circle that ever returneth into the self-same spot, and much madness, and more of sin, and horror the soul of the plot. But see, amid the mimic rout, a crawling shape intrude, a blood-red thing that writhes from out the scenic solitude. It writhes, with mortal pangs, the mimes become its food, and seraphs sob at vermin fangs in human gore imbued. Out, out are the lights, out all, and Over each quivering form, the curtain, a funeral pall, comes down with the rush of a storm, while the angels, all pallid and wan, uprising, unveiling, affirm that the play is the tragedy, man, and its hero, the Conqueror Worm.
It was a violent summer storm. Millions of volts slashed the earth.
That was the worst storm we've had since I was knee-high to a duck.
Folks talked about it and started getting things back to normal when Mick hit town for his vacation.
Well, it's straight ahead about 5 miles.
But things weren't normal. There were changes.
Mother bit me.
I never saw one bite like that.
Strange, frightful changes. That night, it all started.
Stop doing that.
I'm not doing anything.
They came from everywhere. Millions of writhing, seething creatures oozing out of the mire to feed on human flesh. Sweat, but you don't dare move.
Oh no.
Terror grips every nerve in your body. You want to scream, but you can't. Your heart beats so fast, it feels like it's going to burst.
Jerry?
A new experience in pure fright.
And now we continue with the third annual Halloween episode. I feel sort of like the son of Svengoolie. You know, he'd show part of the movie, then he'd come back and do something.
That's what I've wanted to do from the very first time with our Halloween shows, because I love that format. We grew up watching that show, and that's kind of what I was trying to do from the get-go with this show. Uh-huh.
So, tonight, well, last night, I watched Little Shop of Horrors with my kids. Mm-hmm. And they loved it. And I think there are a few scary parts, but mostly startling.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to have nightmares about a plant eating people.
No, they'll have...
Spoiler alert.
The nightmare will revolve around the dentist more than the giant plant.
Yeah. You'll be a dentist. Steve Martin's good in that.
Yes, like, he is.
As soon as John Candy came on as the radio host, they're like, that's that guy from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the guy that does the mess around. I was like, it is. You're right.
Yep.
And then when the dentist comes on, I go, do you know who that is? And they're like, the guy from... Pet detective? No, it's not the guy from the pet detective. I don't know. I was like, he's the other guy from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. They're like, really? No, that guy was old. Like,
this was 1987, kids.
I guess John Candy is timeless.
Yeah.
And ageless. I guess fat people generally are. That's the worst part about losing weight is if you're a dude, anyway. Mm. Women, it doesn't seem to happen to, but with dudes, it's like Tom Arnold looks like the Crypt Keeper now that he's lost all that weight.
Yeah, for every like 100 pounds you lose, you gain like 25 years.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'll always be fat. That's that's it. That's why. Of course, I'll probably die 25 years before I would have otherwise. But other than that, I don't know. You know, you were talking about dressing up for trick-or-treat. Mm-hmm. I do it every year. I was the Grim Reaper. Oh. And I don't know if you've seen me, but I'm quite tall.
Yeah, yeah. I remember you being as such.
Yes. And the Grim Reaper costume that I bought had like the black netting so that you couldn't see my face, and if it was down properly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No kid wanted to walk. Kids were just like, mothers were pulling their kids closer, you know.
Did you have like a big tray of like salmon mousse?
Ooh, that would have been funny.
All you Americans, you're so fucking pompous. You're always saying, let me tell you this, and I just want to say that. Well, now you're dead.
I didn't even eat the mousse.
Shut up, Harvey. All right. Well, this is funny because I was talking with my family about the idea that we don't see things with the advent of the internet. It seems like all the mystery of life has like drained away.
Right.
Because all the things that, you know, we heard when we were kids, you can look up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about how mysteriously now that, you know, in 1976, you know, if Leonard Nimoy could have given a camera to virtually every single person in the world and said, you know, bring me a picture of a UFO or Bigfoot or something,
mm-hmm.
or as my youngest calls it, the lake nose monster, that, you know, that would have been Leonard Nimoy's dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
He would have had material for In Search Of for the rest of his career, right? He wouldn't have to have rebooted Spock,
right,
you know?
Right.
He would have had plenty of money on In Search Of. The thing is, everybody has a camera now.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody carries a camera with them at all times.
Mm-hmm.
So where's all the clear, like it's got like a million megapixel camera in my pocket, right?
Yeah.
At all times.
Right.
Clear, and it even has like these filters and adjustments and things. Like if something's moving, it'll freeze it and like make it super clear. Where's all my pictures of a clear picture of Bigfoot or the lake nose monster or a UFO? And damn it, 2 days later, your sister posts a picture of Bigfoot.
Yeah.
First of all, blurry as hell.
Of course.
Second of all, the exact same pose that every Bigfoot picture from 1976 had. And I thought, oh, this is just somebody's playing around, right? But it was like on Fox News or something.
Yeah.
A so-called legitimate news source.
Well, that's because Bigfoot is analog. You know, he's from the 70s, so he doesn't translate well in the digital. So he has, yeah, that with, like the when they started putting vinyl on CD, they had to go in and enhance it. So if they would go in and remaster that picture of Bigfoot that has just resurfaced, you know, you might be surprised what you see.
I think it's a bear walking on its hind legs.
You know what's funny, though, about those In Search Of? You know, it's 2017, and, you know, we've been and seen, done everything. But if you go back, because I did this, if you go back and you watch old episodes of In Search Of, they are still creepy as hell. I don't know what, I don't know whether I'm viewing them nostalgically, but, I mean, they're still pretty damn creepy to watch to this day.
Is it still believable? Like it holds up? You're like, that never really has been adequately explained.
I think maybe 2% of the encounters that they talked about on In Search Of still hold up to scrutiny. Because they're just weird encounters that, you know, were never really explained.
Speaking of encounters with extraterrestrial life forms, I just finished 2001: A Space Odyssey yesterday.
What'd you think?
Oh my God, it's so good.
Dude, that last line in the book was just amazing. When the Star Child shows up on he's hovering over Earth and he's looking around and he's like, he didn't know quite what to do with his newfound powers, but he'd figure it out.
He'd think of something.
Man, I'm like,
I loved it.
If it hadn't have been for that ending, I never would have read the rest of the books. But I mean, that book, guys like him, guys like Arthur C. Clarke, fall into what I call the dry poets. Their prose is very basic, but poetic as hell when you read it. And man, that was a page turner.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Here's what I did not know about that is how it came about.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I didn't realize it, and now I see why. So Kubrick wants to make this movie, but he's like, but the movie needs to be based on a novel.
Yeah, yeah. Not a short story.
So he's like, here, let me tell you this. Let me tell you about the movie, and then you write the book. And he's like, Clark's like, I hate novelizations of movies. He's like, no, that's not what I'm asking you to do.
Right.
I need the book that the movie's based on. Mm-hmm. He's like, so, but you already have the idea for the movie. How is it not? He's like, never mind. We're working on this together. Come on.
Yes. Yeah. And he just, what was it? He took the short story of The Sentinel, which is a pretty decent short story, and just expanded the hell out of it to make 2001.
So I learned all this in the, a new introduction by the author.
Right.
And then I realized when I got to the end, anybody who's seen the movie without reading the book is probably confused as hell and like, I don't know what I just saw there at the end, right? It's like, what the hell is that even, right? But if you read the book, you'll understand what's going on at the end, right? What that has to do with Halloween, I have no idea.
All I can say is, my God, it's full of stars.
Yeah, it's full of stars.
Where that goes into Halloween is, you know, Bigfoot and UFOs are unexplained phenomenon, as are things like ghosts.
Yes, and everyone has a ghost story.
Yes, they do.
And if you ask my daughter why we don't have pictures of ghosts, as we would expect when everybody has a camera, she says, maybe ghosts don't show up on cameras.
Well, that explains it right there. That completely explains it. The thing, but before we get into the next part of the show, which is primarily ghost stories, the thing is about the ghost stories is I put a couple call-outs on Facebook looking for ghost stories and was deluged with people and their ghost stories.
We wish we could have included everyone's.
Right.
But due to the limitations of time and mainly Paul's time, we couldn't. But there's no reason we, you know, couldn't do it at some point in the future.
Right.
So, you know, thank you for all of your contributions.
The tiny dorm room was split in two. One side was my stuff. The few things on the other side were Sato's. A suitcase, a couple notebooks, a pencil case. One after another, they're thrown into the $2 cardboard moving box. I paused as I picked up the carved wooden sword that Sato had. It wasn't going to fit in the box. I threw it on Sato's skinny mattress. Next was a framed photo of Sato and his sister. Sato had taken it during his time back in Japan while he renewed his student visa. Sato was wearing that heavy white jacket of his. His sister wore a little charm bracelet, one that I had actually helped Sato pick out. Into the box the photo went. Later that day, I helped Justin, Sato's boss, buried the body in a little clearing in the woods that stood as the border between one of the university's fields and the national forest that surrounded the campus. The job done, Justin put a little makeshift Japanese arch over the site. He muttered under his breath and crossed himself. I thought Catholics believe suicides can't get into heaven.
I'll pray for whomever I damn well please. Sato didn't kill himself. All the people who made his life a living hell did. He just did the deed for them.
On my way down the hill and away from the gravesite, I saw something move in the forest. A figure wearing a heavy white jacket. Not moving. Maybe it was just a tree that caught a shadow in a weird way. Hey, Justin, do you,
What?
I was about to gesture toward the figure, but it was gone. Never mind. Later, I was walking through the lecture hall where I used to attend a class with Sato. All the lights were off, and I realized I couldn't remember who I'd come here to see. But this wasn't the first time since Sato's death that I'd found myself wandering around, forgetting what I was doing. I turned a corner and at the far end saw the figure, in the white jacket. It had a sweatshirt hood over its head. I turned and walked away, looking at the floor. But a few paces later, I looked up and saw Sato, wearing the white jacket, standing right in front of me. I ran, Sato's footsteps pounding after me. I made it into a room and shut the door behind me. The door had one of those windows with the metal mesh inside the glass. Sato slammed into the door, his face inches from the glass and partially covered by the shadow of the hood. He tried to pull the handle open, but I held onto it tightly, not letting him. But then two other Satos, two identical figures, came into view, their faces completely covered in shadow, carrying baseball bats. No! I wouldn't let go of the door handle. I wouldn't let the cornered Sato in. One of the doubles swung his bat wide over his head and down onto Sato, sending him to the floor and out of view. They beat him. There were no screams, just the pounding of metal on flesh and bone. I didn't move. I kept a death grip on the door handle. From the gap between the bottom of the door and the floor flowed a crimson pool. I recoiled from the blood, Sato's blood. And one of the duplicates opened the door. It rushed at me with blood-soaked bat raised. Ah! But then I woke up, alone in my dorm room. Later I had lunch with my friend Rick.
He was a jerk. Sounds like he's still being a jerk now that he's dead, just in your dreams.
That's not funny.
Yeah, but I just hate it when people glorify and whitewash someone just because they died. It pisses me off. He was terrible to everyone. And you had to live with the guy.
He wasn't terrible to everyone. He asked me to help him pick out a charm bracelet for his sister in Japan. She was into ponies or something.
Man, he tried to rape my girlfriend, though.
He bought her flowers and waited outside her dorm room. That's not exactly tantamount to attempted rape.
While she was still with me, that little shit. Not even his family wanted him when he was dead. Japan didn't want him. Didn't want to pay for it anyways. That's why you and his boss had to bury him in the forest, right?
What I don't get is why he burned off one of his eyebrows before
Maybe he's haunting you. Do you have anything of his at all? Maybe he has some psychic connection to something he left behind.
Digging a grave is exhausting, unnerving work. Digging up a grave that was recently filled, out in the dark, cold of the middle of the night, is worse. At least I didn't have to dig all the way down. I stumbled back from the gravesite, almost tripping over Sato's wooden sword, as I heard someone laughing. Then Rick, his girlfriend Melanie, and his dumb friend Stan sauntered up the hill and into the moonlit clearing, all carrying assorted beers and fifths. Stan noticed me first.
Whoa, scared the crap out of us there, Marcus. What the hell are you doing?
Rick looked at the shovel in my hand, the beginnings of my digging, and the sword at my feet.
Oh, you took my idea way more seriously than I thought you would.
No, but seriously, what are you doing?
He's burying the samurai sword, dude, because it contains the soul of the warrior.
I felt blood rushing out of the back of my head as I saw something white move in the forest.
warrior. You should have seen the way he cowered when we made...
Stan, shut up.
Rick walked up to me and pulled out a Bic lighter.
Or, maybe we should tell you. Tell you how we told that freak to get the hell out of our school.
Rick filled his hands with fumes from the lighter, then lit it so he could throw a tiny fireball at me. Very dramatically. He was disappointed that it didn't seem to bother me. So he grabbed me by the ear. The motion was so sudden, so odd, and so painful that I didn't even know how to react.
Little roommate, who hated him more than all of us put together, tries to make amends by burying a wooden...
Rick picked up the shovel.
I didn't hate him. I saw it in your eyes. You're glad he's dead.
So he was an asshole, fine. But at least I didn't act like a bigger asshole than he was. Rick considered this, then kicked me in the shoulder to knock me prone. I turned to the arch to find the sword. I wasn't really planning on hitting Rick with it, but maybe if I was holding it, he would back off. But the sword was gone. I looked at Stan and Melanie. They weren't laughing anymore, but didn't seem to have any intention of intervening. But neither of them had the sword either.
Admit it. Admit you hated him, or I'm not letting you go.
As I tried to get back up, Rick swung the shovel handle around and into my arm.
Admit it! You're not-
Stop! We all turned toward the voice. Out of the black trees stepped Sato, wearing the white jacket with the hood over his head. He was holding the wooden sword. His sword. He walked toward Rick. Rick held out the shovel in front of him. Stan and Melanie bolted out of the clearing and out of view. Rick tried to swing the shovel at Sato, but he easily parried the strike away and swung his sword hard to break the shovel handle in two. Rick stumbled back, dropped the splintered handle, and ran. Sato walked past me. I noticed that there was something off about him, other than being a dead man walking. He took off running toward Rick, and I saw something on his wrist, a bracelet with little horse charms dangling from it. As I thought about this, as I put the pieces together, the ghost was gaining on Rick with sword raised. It was my fault! The ghost stopped. He was always doing things. Using my stuff, leaving a mess. He hadn't cleaned his dishes in weeks. I piled the dishes on his bed, and when he got home, he flipped out. The ghost walked back up the hill toward me. I told him that no one could stand him, that he was the worst friend I'd ever had, and that I was tired of looking at him every day. I fell to my knees. The ghost moved to stand over me, the sword held high. Then the fingers relaxed and the sword fell. The ghost, Sato's sister, sat next to me.
He could take incredible abuse from almost anyone. Unless it was from someone he cared about. Or someone he loved. Or someone who was supposed to love him.
She pulled the hood back to reveal a face covered by long hair as dark as the shadows in the trees. I don't know what to do.
I came here to ask him to come back home. When I found out, I wanted to kill whoever made him do this.
She looked over her shoulder and gestured at the Japanese arch.
Atori isn't a headstone, you know.
Sato's boss put that there. He was trying to be respectful.
Were you really going to bury his sword in his grave?
I had to do something. To stop the dreams.
You can't stop them. You can only wait for them to fade.
Evil science was practiced in this laboratory of nightmares. Who is this irresistible creature who has an insatiable love for the dead? What dread terror stalked the townspeople? The legend of Frankenstein once again brings terror and nightmare to the screen. Thank you. forgotten as Baron Frankenstein, the scientist who dared to create a monster. Meet Lady Frankenstein. She's beautiful, she's evil, and she'll do anything for love.
Think of me. Think of possessing me. Would you like to have my body bend to you? Would you like to make love to me?
She creates a new, more terrifying monster.
I am my father's daughter.
Only the monster she creates can satisfy her strange desires. No man can escape her web of terror. There has never been a movie like Lady Frankenstein.
Good evening. This is Victor Von Psychotron, host of Weirdorama on YouTube, your source for all the creepy, strange, and weird things in the worlds of cinema and television. And you are listening to the special Halloween episode of the Don't Panic radio show. The following is based on true events.
My ex-wife and I had just moved into a loft in downtown Los Angeles. It was 3,000 square feet, and after we were finished renovating the place, we decided to have a party. We invited three bands to play, and approximately 200 people showed up. And in between bands, while they were setting up, some people were going to the bathroom. We had two bathrooms, and some people were using the bathrooms in the front of the loft, and some people were using bathrooms at the back of the loft. A couple of girls refused to use the bathroom in the back. It was dark, and we hadn't gotten lights up all the way down the hallway yet. One guy had convinced his girlfriend to go back into the back area, use the bathroom, and I think they were gonna like smoke some pot or something like that too. About a minute after they went back there, she came running out of the dark, screaming her head off, and ran down the steps onto the street. We had 24 steps from the loft down to the street level. And she ran down those steps, screaming and telling everybody that this place was haunted, and she refused to go back there, and she was crying and hysterical, and refused to go back into the loft to enjoy the party. And then a couple other people chimed in saying, yeah, they felt weird there, and they felt like somebody was like touching them when there was nobody around. I found out later, a lot of people refused to go into the back area where it was darker. We ended up living there for 6 years, and we noticed things would be moved around, and nobody was there except us. We had two dogs at the time, and two cats, and her and I. And things sometimes would just be moved, like in the kitchen area or in the living room area. And one day I came home from work, and I walked up those 24 steps to the top area. And at the top area was a living area where we had a TV and two couches set up. And laying in the middle of the living room area was a big metal piece, like an iron rod or something. I thought maybe my girlfriend had brought it up the steps for some reason, and I was waiting for her to get home, and I just kind of left it there. And I think I went off to do something, maybe start dinner or something like that. And she came home not too long after me and asked me what the rod, metal piece of iron was doing in the middle of the in the room. I said, I don't know, I thought you put it there. And she said, no, she'd been gone all day. So nobody could figure out what that was about. And it was just laying there. And I ended up leaning it up against the wall, and then that was it. We kind of forgot about it. And really, at the end, we thought maybe someone was playing a prank on us. I'm also a painter, and I had a piece of tin that somebody had gifted to me, and I was going to paint on this piece of tin. And we had a friend staying there at our loft one night, and I had the piece of tin laying against one of the couches in the living room area, and my girlfriend and I were asleep in bed one night, and our friend was staying there. Probably around 1 or 2 in the morning, the three of us woke up. Our friend was sleeping on one of the couches in the living room area, and our friend heard the piece of tin moving, and it kind of woke me up too, and my girlfriend. Later on, I found out all three of us were listening to it as it moved from one room, from the couch area, to a spot near my girlfriend and I's head on the other side of the wall. And we were kind of like freaked out about that because we all talked about it the next morning. And our friend said he didn't move the piece of tin. And I didn't move the piece of tin, and she didn't move the piece of tin. And somehow it moved to another section of the loft. The best one is the last one. My friend Dana was over, and we were going to go get some sushi. We live next to Little Tokyo in downtown LA, and we were waiting for my girlfriend to get home. And we had all wood floors, and the ceilings were 30 feet high, so there was a lot of echo in the place too. We were watching TV. We had another TV set up in a front room area, and we were watching TV waiting for her to get home. So she, you know, we were just sitting there, and we, you know, because she, when we got there, the place was dark, and so we figured she was gone. And we're like, okay, we'll wait for her to go have dinner when she gets home. We're sitting there, and we hear someone walking down the hallway in high heels coming towards the room where we're sitting. And it's getting louder and louder. And I go, oh, I guess she's home. We can go to dinner now. So we waited for her to come into the door, and we heard the heels, and it was like she was pacing up and down the hallway. We stopped, and I went to the door, and I opened the door, and there's nobody out there. And I said, well, she must have gone into one of the rooms, so I think I went into the kitchen area or the bathroom area, and nobody was there. And I went back to the TV area, and I said, hey, Dana, did you hear that? He goes, yeah, I heard her walking around. And I said, well, nobody's here. And he said, that's impossible. We just heard her walking around. I said, no, there's no one here. There's no one here besides us. A few minutes later, I hear the front door at street level open up and close, and then someone comes up this 24 stairs to the top of the loft, and it's my girlfriend. And I said, hey, you just get home? And she goes, yeah. And I said, well, what do you mean? We heard you walking around. You had heels on. She goes, no, I just walked in the door. And I said, oh, well, somebody's walking up and down the hallway in heels. And she said, well, it wasn't me because I just got home. And I said, yeah, I can see that. So I never really had an explanation for that one either. But it was my friend Dana and I both heard that clearly. And someone walking up and down the hallway in heels. And I think we ended up leaving that loft about maybe a year later or so. We've actually kept in contact with other people who've moved in there, and they've also experienced odd things in that place. And it's, definitely, the place was built in 1929, and it's just something weird going on in that place. Never did have an explanation for any of it.
I was out on the West Coast trying to make a buck, and things didn't work out. I was down on my luck. Got tired of roaming and bumming around, so I started thumbing back east toward my hometown. Made a lot of miles the first 2 days, and I figured I'd be home in a week if my luck held out this way. But the third night I got stranded way out of town. At a cold, lonely crossroads, rain was pouring down. I was hungry and freezing, done caught a chill, when the lights of a big semi topped the hill. Lord, I sure was glad to hear them air brakes come on. And I climbed in that cab, where I knew it'd be warm. At the wheel sat a big man. He weighed about 210. He stuck out his hand and said with a grin, "Big Joe's the name." I told him mine. And he said the name of my rig is Phantom 309. Well, I asked him why he called his rig such a name. He said, "Son, this old Mac can put them all to shame. There ain't a driver or a rig a running any line that's seen nothing but taillights from Phantom 309. Well, we rode and talked the better part of the night when the lights of a truck stop came in sight. He said, "I'm sorry, son, this is as far as you go, because I gotta make a turn just on up the road." Well, he tossed me a dime as he pulled her in low and said, "Have yourself a hot cup on old Big Joe." When Joe and his rig roared out in the night, in nothing flat, he was clean out of sight. Well, I went inside and ordered me a cup, told the waiter Big Joe was setting me up. Oh, you could have heard a pin drop. It got deathly quiet, and the waiter's face turned kind of white. "Well, did I say something wrong?" I said with a halfway grin. He said, "No, this happens every now and then. Every driver in here knows Big Joe. But son, let me tell you what happened about 10 years ago. At the crossroads tonight where you flagged him down, there was a busload of kids coming from town. And they were right in the middle when Big Joe topped the hill. It could have been slaughter, but he turned his wheels. Well, Joe lost control, went into a skid, and gave his life to save that bunch of kids. And there at that crossroads was the end of a line for Big Joe and Phantom 309. But every now and then, some hiker will come by, and like you, Big Joe will give him a ride. Here, have another cup, and forget about the dime. Keep it as a souvenir from Big Joe and Phantom 309.
Hey everybody, I'm Andy Wright, and I want to tell you about my audiobook podcast, Worlds of Maybar. It's about a multiverse where self-proclaimed gods have quietly ruled for over 800 years, but the one founding member of their order that condemned their methods has just been set loose after being locked away for all those years. It's got romance, magic, revenge, buses with insect legs, and the ever-frustrating question of how to demand justice from the bad guys without becoming a bad guy yourself. I read each chapter myself and throw in a little music for atmosphere, so it's kind of like story time with Andy. I've got 7 chapters up for the first book, The New Aleph, and new chapters are posting every other Monday at worldsofmaybar.com. That's worldsofmebar.com. Steve says it's spelled Mebar, but you know better than to listen to him. Anyway, have a great Halloween, everybody.
The clock on the bedside table read 2:07 a.m. Why the heck, thought Ken through the fog of half-sleep, is someone taking a bath? He focused a moment longer, fighting sleep, to be sure he wasn't imagining the distant sound of water filling a tub. They had only been living in the new house a few months, so he wasn't familiar with all the noises the house made at night. He was certain, however, that running water wasn't one of them. Looking over his shoulder, he saw his wife, Maddie, sleeping soundly beside him. The room was dark, but moonlight streaming in through a window lent vague shape to the objects of the room. Not her, he thought. The water continued, the sound of it becoming more distinct as Ken was reluctantly and fully stirred to consciousness. The sound was clear now, coming down the hall beyond their door, which they usually kept open at night, so as to hear if their son Dylan woke for any reason. Not wishing to disturb the slumbering Maddie, Ken carefully climbed out of bed and crept to the door. Just to be sure, Ken peered in on Dylan, who, in typical fashion, was snoring peacefully in the oversized race car bed. That's a relief, he thought. Just out of diapers, Dylan had a precocious streak, and Ken wouldn't have put it past the boy on a nighttime trip to the bathroom to start some kind of mischief. A moment later, Ken found the bathroom door ajar, the sound of running water coming from the darkness beyond. He slowly pushed past the door, flicking on the lights. The cascading sound of water pouring into the now half-filled tub echoed about the room. He quickly turned it off and, on a whim, checked the water temperature with his fingers. Not hot, not cold, but darn near perfect. Pulling the plug, Ken was drying his hand on his pajama shirt when he heard another faint sound coming from further down the hall and around the corner. A moment's focus told him it was the TV in the living room playing softly. He made his way through the darkness to the living room, where the TV's flickering light filled the room with dancing shadows. On the TV, Gene Autry was singing You Are My Sunshine from an old movie Ken didn't recognize. Not much to be said about late night TV, he thought as he switched it off and returned to bed. Had to be the boy, was his final thought as he drifted back to sleep.
Ken! Ken! Wake up!
Maddie was shaking him, stirring him from sleep.
Do you hear that?
She whispered. Hear what?
Shh! That! The TV!
Again?
Again?
Sitting up, Ken said, it happened a few weeks ago. He listened a moment, then only the tub was running too.
Do you think it's Dylan? She asked. Wait, the tub? Good Lord, he could have drowned.
I thought it was at first, but he was sawing logs when I checked on him. What's really crazy is that is the same song I heard before.
What? No.
Apparently whatever channel that is doesn't have too much late night programming.
Well, who's up this late anyway?
Us, apparently, he said, pulling himself out of bed. I'll take care of it.
Weird,
Maddie thought as Ken disappeared out of the room. The next morning, over breakfast, amidst the hustle of their weekday routine, they asked Dylan if he'd gotten up in the middle of the night and turned on the TV. Looking over his bowl of cereal, he looked as if he had no idea what they were talking about. Daddy doesn't like me messing with the TV, he said finally. That's because Daddy is a remote control hog, said Maddie, tousling her son's hair. Everyone laughed.
Dude, wake up.
Bears just scored. Ken heard the words as he was jostled awake, snorting, somewhat embarrassed. The cheers of the crowd came skirling off the TV and washed over him as he regained his footing on consciousness. Dude, what's been going on? Asked Floyd, his neighbor, who, as luck would have it, turned out to be a Bears fan, and the two had become fast friends in the months that Ken and his family had lived in their new house.
That's the second time you've nodded off. You narcoleptic or something?
I wish, Ken chuckled. No, we had an incident last night, that's all.
Incident?
What kind of incident?
Nothing really.
Well, it's kind of something. It's weird. For some reason, about a half a dozen times since we moved here, I've found the bathtub running and the TV on late at night.
Not so weird, Floyd shrugged, sipping his beer.
Probably that boy of yours. My rugrat does that kind of thing all the time.
I thought that too, Ken interrupted. But Dylan's always fast asleep, and it's always the same thing on TV.
Well, late night programming kind of sucks, offered Floyd.
What is it?
Some singing cowboy, said Ken. Gene Autry, I think.
You Are My Sunshine, I think?
Wait, you think or you know?
Well, I'm pretty sure that's it. Why?
That's weird, dude. Tell me about it.
No, I mean the song, said Floyd. Did you ever meet the old lady who owned this place before you?
No, we went through a realtor. Why?
Well, she lived here with her daughter. Her daughter had 2 or 3 kids. I guess she was divorced. I never asked. Anyway, one of the kids, this bouncy little girl, used to run around the yard singing You Are My Sunshine.
Marie, I think her name was.
Get out of here, chuckled Ken, sipping his beer.
Dude, I'm serious. Floyd hesitated a moment, then, ever hear why they sold this place?
No. Again, we went through the realtor.
There was a terrible car accident, said Floyd. The mom and Marie didn't make it. I guess the dad got custody of the other kids after that. Nice enough guy. Met him a few times. Hates football, though. Can you imagine? Anyway, he got the kids, and the old lady moved into one of those assisted living apartments. You know, for old people.
Get out of here, Floyd. That's crazy. Google it, dude. Ken laughed again, more to convince himself that his neighbor was joking than anything else. But later that night, while his wife and son slept, Ken found himself back on the living room couch, thumb scrolling across the screen of his phone. Hello? Hello, Mrs. Novak? Yes? Who's this? Hi, Mrs. Novak. You don't know me, but my name is Ken. My family bought your house. How did you get my number? I'm sorry, ma'am. I hope you don't mind, but the realtor gave it to me. And I wouldn't bother you, but, well, it's kind of strange. Well, I'm sure if there's something wrong with the house, you could take it up with... It's not that, ma'am. Not exactly. What then? Well, ma'am, I hate to ask, but it's about the accident. A tense moment passed. Then the tiny voice on the other end of the line said, "What about it?" Ken spent the next few minutes fumbling over the details. The words sounded crazy as he heard himself say them, and he instantly regretted even making the call once he was through. There was a long silence. Then, "Are you sure that's the song?" "Yes, ma'am. Even looked it up on YouTube." More silence. Marie loved all those old songs, the old woman said at last. But that one was her favorite. She sang it all the time. This can't be a coincidence, he thought. I'm not one to believe in the supernatural, ma'am. But try as I might, none of it makes any normal sense. There was nothing normal about that little angel, said the old woman. She was an old soul, for sure, and she never met a stranger in her short life. This sort of thing doesn't surprise me. Well, he said, half chuckling, it surprises the heck out of me and my family. Marie used to get cold at night, said the old woman. She was just a little thing, you see. There were many nights that she'd get up and take a bath because she was cold, see? Then in the morning, we'd find her all curled up on the floor in front of the TV. Are you serious? Very. There were many mornings we'd find water all over the floor in the bathroom because of it. My guess, Ken, is that she is still in your house in some way and is doing what she can do to stay warm. I'm sure she's somehow with her mother, but she probably misses her brother and sister. They live with Dwight, their father, across town. Perhaps she... Mrs. Novak, I... don't believe in ghosts? Well, not exactly. Young man, when you reach my age, you will understand that what you believe in doesn't so much define your reality as limited. Well, whatever it is, it's causing no end of stress on my family and me. I've had to miss work from lack of sleep. Marie was a sensitive young girl, said the old woman. I'm sure if you tell her she's upsetting you and your family, she'll stop. You think that will work? What harm is there in trying? But I would tell her tonight, before it happens again. She's probably scared, cold, and lonely at that point. Better to reason with her while she's not. True, he said at length. Young man? Yes. Will you tell her I love her? Yes, ma'am. Before the whole thing started, Ken would have felt foolish sitting on the floor in the dark in front of the TV while his family slept. As it was now, he still felt a little bit crazy over the whole thing. With his eyes closed, he took one last calming breath. Marie, he said softly, not wishing to wake his family, if you are here, please know that while you're welcome here, you need to, well, could you please keep it down? You're scaring me and my family. A feeling of foolishness came over him as he finished the words. Had his wife not heard the sounds of the TV as well, he would be certain he was going crazy. Your grandma told me you were a good girl, he continued, biting back the feeling. She told me to tell you she loves you very much, and I, Ken, felt the sudden chill run up his spine. Opening his eyes, he glanced over his shoulder, fully expecting to find his wife or son standing beside him. Having woke from the sound of his voice, there was no one there.
Dad! Dad, wake up!
Dwight opened his eyes, struggling to regain consciousness, to discover the alarmed faces of his young son and daughter hovering over him.
Bennett? Ross?
He mumbled, confused.
What's the matter?
Around them, the darkness of the bedroom was lit by a faint, flickering pillar of light across the floor from the open door. The clock on the nightstand read 2:07. The TV. It just came on, whispered Rose, pointing with her free hand, her other hand clutching tightly to a well-worn, well-loved stuffed cat. Listen, whispered Bennett.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
If anyone listening has any experience with conjuring spirits, that's what we want to do for the fourth annual Halloween episode.
I know a couple of people, and I'm working on that. But yes, anyone within the sound of our voice.
Has a seance ever been done on a podcast? I'm sure we could Google and find out. Yes. But how awesome would it be to have the first ever live appearance of an actual, honest to goodness, real life spirit?
Wait, you can't say real life spirit because they're dead.
Okay, let me try it differently. An honest to God, real life. What? An honest to God. Can't say God either, probably, right? All right, never mind. We'll get to that next year. Which you probably ought to start working on next year's Halloween episode.
About February, I'm going to launch into it.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I hope you were scared. I hope you were entertained. If you weren't scared, then maybe you didn't turn the lights down low enough.
That's right.
Yeah. But just wanted to let everybody know a couple of things. We're going to take a week off, so the next episode will post on November 8th.
Right.
If you're listening to this, well, here's the thing. You get an extra week to listen to this one to get you in the mood for Halloween. And if you miss Halloween, like miss it, like, oh, man, I miss Halloween, then you can continue listening to this for a whole other week.
Right.
Before the next episode drops. So,
or if you want to listen to something truly terrifying, during that week, you can go back and listen to some of our earliest episodes.
Yeah, there you go.
Those are truly terrifying.
I don't know about terrifying. Certainly disturbing.
That's true.
That having been said, this time more so than any other Halloween episode, we could not have done it without the help of our friends. And so Paul has a list of people to thank, and I just want to say from me, thank you so much. It's so fun to co-create with friends and creative people who are doing it not for fame or fortune, although I'm sure fame and or fortune would be welcomed. That's not why they're doing it. They're doing it just because it's fun to do. And there you go. So I want to thank my youngest and my for the Rockabye Baby, and I want to thank my oldest for the Boil, Toil and Trouble. They'll both be missed.
Of course, I would like to thank Andy Wright, Sean Malarkey, and Jalissa Eliason for their work in Ghostblade.
I want to thank Andy Wright for having one of the coolest names ever, A. William Wright.
That's right. as he's known on the show.
And also his buddies, whose name is Malarkey. I've never met anyone named Malarkey before.
Apparently he doesn't have any problem with that, according to a William Wright. Also, I'd like to thank my daughter, Arlo, and her friend, Riley, for their work on the Three Witches at the beginning of the episode. My friend, Adam Ulrich, for 24 Steps. And my former in-law-turned-friend, Jason Tuttle, for his ghost story that appeared at the end of this episode, which corresponds to ghost stories that from my household that I've told on previous episodes. So it's kind of a tie-in there. And of course, Victor Von Psychotron for all of his help on our shows. He's the best. And of course, we have to thank Superfan James for making us step up our game this year.
I hope he likes it. Oh my God. If he doesn't like this one, I might kill myself.
We'll have to come up with something else to do on Halloween.
Yeah, right. We'll do our Christmas episode early. All right. Well, that's another one in the books, man.
So,
another Halloween episode in the books.
A book of scary stories. The book of the dead.
So, for all of those people that Paul just mentioned, and for Paul Schultz, I'm Steve Vincent. And nothing.
You just heard what's true.
She's in love with herself. She likes the dark. And on her milk white neck, the devil's mark. Now it's All Hallows' Eve. The moon is full. But will she trick or treat? I bet she will. She's got a daylight midnight with those four and two.
Yeah.
I am my father's daughter.